Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello. I am so glad you're able to join me this evening because we are going to be talking about something that's very important, and that is you. That is your wellness, and we are going to take you on a journey of information that I think, in some respects, is going to come as a surprise to you because we, yes, will be talking about nutrition and we're going to be talking about exercise, but we've got some extra points of information that I think you, whether you're single, have a family, it doesn't make any difference. It will be information that you can use that you actually will be able to share with your physician when you go in for your annual physical. And if you're not having a regular physical, I'm going to scold you. You need to do it. Why? Because this body that you occupy is your chassis. And if you don't take care of your chassis, you're not going to have very much strength or stamina to be able to enjoy life to the fullest. And that is what Daniela Forrest is all about with her book, Own Your Wellness, giving you the tools to break through your health plateaus. Daniela, welcome to the show.
Donna, thank you for having me.
Daniela, you have done such a comprehensive book here. Give us your background. What was it that made you decide that you were going to become engaged with an environment that we must have a few billion resources to be able to reference to, but you've really moved up the ladder as far as providing information to people that's very current for today?
Thank you. Well, I am a functional diagnostic practitioner, and what that means is essentially I'm a health coach. I work with people to eat better, make sure they're sleeping, they're moving, et cetera. But what differentiates me is that I'm able to order testing for my clients because, you know, after I worked as a personal trainer for over 20 years, and I still do to some respects, but regardless of whether you're getting your exercise in or eating your veggies or getting a good night's sleep, I still had so many clients who just didn't feel well, and we couldn't quite figure out why. I needed additional tools to be able to look under the hood, so to speak, and figure out where we were missing healing opportunities for these people. And it could be as simple as some food sensitivities, could be mold exposure at home. It could be genetics that were a problem. It could be gut function, detoxification, hormones. There are so many places to look. And once I had all these wonderful tools, I was able to then put together these puzzle pieces for my clients into something that made a little bit more sense, and then be able to give them actionable choices, things that we could do to move their health forward positively.
How did this affect you as an individual? Because you've gone through this process. This is something that you have not only lived, but you've used yourself as an experiential model.
And I continue to do so. Yes, well, when I first was studying with functional diagnostic nutrition, I was actually at the tail end of a separation, which was, you know, very stressful period of my life. And I had horrific stomach issues at the time. I was sick on an almost daily basis. I became exceptionally thin, regardless of how much food I could eat. And so I ran a lot of these tests on myself. And it was remarkable to find that I was dealing with parasites. My immune system had been suppressed, and these things were able to, you know, take hold of me. I was able to eradicate that. My hormones were dysregulated. My cortisol was in the tank. I needed better nutrition. I needed better rest. And I clearly needed some supplementation to help me get to where I was trying to go. And since then, you know, I continue to use this framework on myself, working with my doctor, of course. I don't prescribe anything for myself, but, you know, I'm adjusting my hormones to make sure that my bones stay strong and I keep my cognition as I'm getting older. I'm, you know, working on diet and exercise adjustments, you know, all the time. I think that one thing that's not discussed often enough in the health world that I work in is that once you instigate certain changes and things are working well for you, it is critical that we are reevaluating on a regular basis because things will stop working and we have to make adjustments as they do and not just do more of the same thing and expect a different result.
In your book, you go into a lot of information regarding nutrition and regarding exercise, which is very, very good. There were a number of different points that I found so interesting. And that is in the section on your book, Own Your Own Wellness, you go into very clear layperson's language about supplementation, about nutrition, its relativeness to food. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting was that when it's cooking green vegetables, that you throw away the water. I remember being told that once you cook something, that water is what you should drink and eliminate eating the vegetables that are in it. In other words, have a soup, and that's going to be better for you if you have the soup because you're getting, you know, whatever vegetables might be in there. But when it came to the greens, actually, there was a nutrient because it was cooked. And I'm thinking of collards. I think of, you know, among the black people in the South, when you would fix collards or kale, you'd never use the first batch of water. You'd always use the second batch. And this is amazing. So tell us how you discovered that.
Well, actually, I was just, it's funny you bring that one up because I just hung up with a client this afternoon who he deals with kidney stones on occasional basis. And actually, it's been my older gentlemen that I work with who have these kidney stones that they end up having to pass, where I did more and more research on this. I had already learned about the concept of oxalates and phytates. There's all kinds of other. The reality is, I think, let me pull this back for just a second. Plants, one of the reasons that they're so healthy for us is they put out these chemicals in their growth that protects them and keeps animals from eating them alive, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, some of these are very protective for us when we do consume these plants. Some of them actually can hurt us. So oxalates are a good example. High oxalate content in certain foods, such as spinach and kale, when they're in their raw form, will bind to calcium. And worse yet, they can form crystals, not just in our kidneys, but in our joints. They can prevent proper absorption of that calcium for strong bones. And when I was very young, I developed osteoporosis. So I was already aware of this issue, but I hadn't much thought about it beyond how it affects bone strength. And as I was working with men who are a little bit older, dealing with these kidney stones, I started to do more research on it. And, you know, they think they're doing the right thing, you know, eating these kale salads and, and sounds like healthier foods, you know, or doing these green smoothies. Well, if you're having a bunch of that stuff on a daily basis, these oxalates will build up. Your calcium absorption will definitely not be optimized. And they can do much more harm than good.
It is so fascinating to me that you put this in your book because I did an interview with a gentleman who was trying to educate men about their prostate. And this was a fellow that was eating spinach, raw spinach, doing everything that he thought was the healthy stuff. And he ended up with not just crystals in his body, but also developing a level of cancer. And he had a nutritionist he became aware of who was a scientist, and he wanted to know what he was eating. He said, I need to know what you're putting into your body. So he told him about it. And he said, okay, I'm going to do some tests on you. And by the time the tests were done, he discovered that what he was eating was totally wrong for his body. Now, this brings about information that he said, I thought eating raw spinach was better than having it cooked. And the doctor said, no, it's not. Not for you. Not with your physiology. So here we've got these little gold nuggets that you put in your book that are just so amazing. And that goes along with the vitamin K that is so often needed if someone bruises very easily. I can remember being told that when I was a young woman, oh, you bruise so easily, you lack vitamin K. Well, they didn't know very much about vitamin K, and I was never educated on nutrition relative to what we are aware of today. But vitamin K actually can be held in the fat cells, especially with women. And I just, you know, you bring this out in the book and you go, oh my goodness, learn something else.
Well, there's, I want to be careful when we're talking about vitamin K because there's two different types of vitamin K. And I think I actually mentioned in the book, I truly wish that vitamin K2 had a different name because the way that the menaquinones work are so different than vitamin K1. So vitamin K1, many of your listeners might be familiar with that. That if you're on a blood thinner, you know, we're talking about bruising and vitamin K. If you're on a blood thinner, your doctor will often tell you to avoid vitamin K because it is an anticoagulant. And so there's that. But vitamin K2 is more focused. I like to call it the traffic cop of calcium. It helps your body to direct these minerals into the correct tissues so that it doesn't end up in your kidneys, your joints, in all the wrong places, right? We want calcium to help keep our bones strong, yes, but also for healthy muscle contraction and other functions in the body. And if we're not having sufficient K2, which, by the way, is unfortunately not easy to get enough of in our diet, then calcium metabolism will further be challenged. And I, when I, like I said earlier, I developed osteoporosis at a horrifically young age. It is my life's mission to continue to fight against it. But, you know, as a 28-year-old woman who was eating, you know, nothing but dairy most of the day through exercising incessantly, I was told that I needed to eat more calcium, take my calcium pill, and exercise more. That was the advice I was given. And I'm like, that's not possible. I couldn't possibly eat more dairy if I wanted to. It's not about the dairy. It's about what minerals are you taking in? Are you able to digest and assimilate them? And are they in the right ratios to be utilized by the body appropriately? The doctor did not tell me to take vitamin D or magnesium or boron or K2, which are also critical to the strength of your bones. And it makes me very sad. I still have women who come to me in middle age whose doctors tell them to take a calcium pill. And I tell them, no. It's actually a rare human who's not eating enough calcium. I don't even eat dairy anymore, and I get plenty of calcium. It's about what are you doing with the calcium that you are taking in and where is it being deposited?
This is so important. We're having to unlearn a lot of what was promoted, you know, in the past generations, because now we are finding that the technologies on DNA, the genetics, epigenetics, the, all of these different terms that are coming together. What is it? Nutrigenetics now? It's being used as a term. And I was really surprised, and this happened a few years ago, when I went in for an exam, an annual exam, and I said, you know, you guys don't do a urine test anymore. And they go, no, the nurses said, no, it's not, it doesn't do any good. And I thought, that's very strange, because the urine of a person can give a lot of information. And it basically has been eliminated from the standard medical checkup environment where it used to be something that you always did. And there Yeah, and it was after a period of fasting, but now it's totally been eliminated. Now, you talk about something I had never heard of before. You call it Dutch. It's a Dutch urine sample. What in the world is that? And share with my listeners why it's so important that this test be done. Do doctors have access? Do labs? I mean, do you have to go to a special lab for this? What do they do?
Sure. So there is a company called Dutch, and it stands for Dried Urine Test for Comprehensive Hormones. It is by far the my darling test. I like to run this test on everyone, myself included, at least twice a year. What does it do? It is a urine test. It's very simple. It's a kit you get sent to your home. You pee on this little litmus paper 4 or 5 times a day. And what it's looking for, it's not just what hormones you're excreting throughout the day, but what are the metabolites of those hormones? So here's what I mean by that. If I have someone who's on hormone replacement or considering going on hormone replacement, and their doctor orders blood work to see what those hormone levels are at the moment, the problem with that information is it only gives you a snapshot in that person's day. Just this one little moment in time. What was their estrogen, testosterone, progesterone, cortisol? That's all it tells you. It doesn't tell you what was it doing 2 hours ago. And it also doesn't tell you, is your body able to detoxify those hormones in a healthy way? So this test, we'll stick with the estrogen example, right? So if a woman's going on estrogen replacement or considering doing so, we can see not only what are their levels of estrogens, but it takes a look at all three of the main estrogen types, estrone, estradiol, and estriol. And then it tells us, how is your body detoxifying those hormones, which we need to be doing on a daily basis? If they are going down a carcinogenic pathway, then we need to be very careful with giving additional hormones to this person. Before we do that, we need to make sure that their detoxification pathways are optimized so that we don't end up with cancer down the road. And this is very topical because we just, you know, are finally learning that hormone replacement for women in particular is not the devil that we thought it was. But we still have to be careful with who we're giving these hormones to, at what doses, and in what combinations to make sure that their bodies can handle that load.
Mm-hmm.
I ran this test on my husband a while ago because, you know, he carries a little around the middle, even when he's in his best shape. And what we were seeing is his very high cortisol levels, right? This is your main stress hormone, which we need to function throughout the day. But what that hormone does is it causes us to release blood sugar into the system. And that extra sugar was causing extra adiposity in his midsection, right? And that adipose tissue then gets converted into estrogen, which means his testosterone is not optimized because estrogens are too high. So there's things we can do with that information to make lifestyle, diet, movement adjustments. And he doesn't need to go on testosterone replacement, right? It just requires some better supplementation and better diet.
Well, and you think of all the ads. I know here I'm in the Seattle area, and I'll hear ads about, oh, men, if your testosterone level, this, that, or the other. It's the same. It may not have just what you've described with your husband. He does not need extra testosterone. He needs a different type of chemical rebalancing. And that's my terminology, but it's harmonizing the body so that it works to assist in keeping the body strong, healthy. And as you say, that can change. People can go through traumas. They can get sick. There's all kinds of things that can happen to them. and it throws the body system out of whack. You know, maybe they're on a trip in the middle of Africa and all they can eat is a bunch of root vegetables and maybe not even have a whole bunch of water and God knows what else it might be. And they're having the time of their life and it's thrown their body just entirely out of whack. So they have to come back and restabilize their body. And that may take a process. So I use that. That's an extraordinarily exaggerated example, but I hope that the point is being made. Also, you go into the detail of how we can do these different tests. Now, just about everybody I know, when they go in, if they've got a halfway decent physician, the physician is going to say, we want to do blood tests on you. We want to do this, that, or the other. But I have found in my own personal experience, you've got to ask for a specific test. Because lots of times they won't even do it. They won't even think of it. Maybe they've just gone through surgery or they've got a very heavy schedule. They're short-staffed. They've only got 10 minutes. But you need to have in hand a list of what you want tested so that they will order that. And then you have to make sure that you have somebody you can talk to so you know how to read the cotton picking report when it comes out because it looks like it's in another language, and it is.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. I spend a lot of time going through my clients, just basic comprehensive medical, you know, blood work that they get once a year. And, you know, for certain people, there are quite a few things that would be helpful to know, you know, inflammatory markers like homocysteine and hsCRP. There are thyroid markers. If you have a history of thyroid disease in your family or if you're not feeling, you know, optimal, you know, running just a TSH, I actually go into some great detail about thyroid testing in the book, mm-hmm. because you really have to ask for these extra tests. I've seen blood work come back without even vitamin D on there. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, are you kidding? You know, I try very hard to position myself with my clients as an ally to their doctor. Quite often I will give my clients bullet points to copy and paste in an email to their doctor or to bring with them to their appointment, talking points and questions so that we can all be on the same team. And the reality is if the doctor's giving a prescription or a diagnosis, they don't have the time to check up on that patient on a Tuesday morning to see if they went for their walk or ate their veggies for dinner the night before. But I do. And so I really try to give this sort of a team framework to my client's situation so that they know that I'm there to assist them. I'm not there to be antagonistic with the doctor at all. But I will push to make sure that we're getting the complete picture of their health that we can.
Yes, and I think that is very important. And fortunately, today, people are saying, I want to be better informed. And when you can work with your physician, and I think most doctors really want to do the best that they can. And with the circumstances today, they've got so many obstacles around them, in front of them, that a lot of good physicians have retired from their positions. But there is a change in medical education. Nutrition is something that's coming more and more to the forefront. And there are those physicians that are called functional physicians, mm-hmm. that are doctors that are saying, we cannot just go by symptoms. We want to work more towards prevention of illness. And that is vitally, vitally important. So you go into the test, you go into the basic blood test, you talk about the functional blood chemistry analysis, and I know that there are, you know, some companies that do this, and this is something that people may say, gee, well, how would I do this if this isn't covered under my medical insurance and I want to pay for this out of pocket? Where can I go? The thyroid marker section that you have in the book for women, but even for men, I think is extraordinarily detailed, and I've not seen this much detail in the past. I've seen some of the detail you mentioned, but not all of it. And so much of it that is relative to this, like the life DNA. The DNA factor alone, just in the past 10 years, has opened up all kinds of information regarding physical characteristics. And this is becoming even more refined as more and more knowledge is obtained. So all of this can be terrific. But you also mentioned the Oxford Biomedical Technologies Mediator Release Test. That's abbreviated, fortunately, to MRT. Mm-hmm. And what does that entail? What goes on with that particular test? Why is that so valuable?
I just love this test. You know, food sensitivities is a topic that almost every client of mine wants to talk about at some point. And it's really important. And, you know, depending on the time of our lives and the sorts of stress that we've been subjected to and whatnot, there are different foods that we're more sensitive to at different times in our lives. The MRT, essentially, when we have an immune reaction to food, your immune system sends out these mediators, right? So it sends out immune cells to deal with a problem, mount a response, and try to recover. So what they do is they take a relatively large blood sample, actually, and they break it up into, I believe right now it's 176 different food antigens. It could be more at this point. But they put your drop of blood with a little bit of this food antigen, and they let it react. First thing they do is they measure the volume of your white blood cells in that sample before they drop it in. After it reacts with the food antigen, they remeasure the volume of your white blood cells. If it has changed significantly, then we know you are highly reactive to that food. The less change in volume, the less reactive you are to that food. And so then it lays out, and I think I give a sample of my own mediator release test in there somewhere. Mm-hmm. And it lays them out for you, you know, as far as the foods that you're most reactive to at this point in time. Now, this does not test for food allergies, so I should be clear. There are other tests that I can run that do that. But this does test your immune system's reactivity to specific foods.
This, I think, is very valuable to know, because so many individuals today are having serious problems with their immune system. And this is coming more and more to the forefront. And to be able to know that you can work with your body, that there actually is a test that can be done. But one of the things that you emphasize is that people need to pay attention to how their bodies respond to things. And this is something that so many of us get so busy, we'll just grab whatever is handy and mm-hmm. we'll just eat it, or we'll take a handful of supplements. And this is something we're not paying attention to, how our body is utilizing those supplements, and that we may not need certain supplements at certain right. times of the year. Or there's just all of this fascinating information that is evolving. And I know people will make certain comments about, oh, well, everything was much better, you know, back in 1800s, or food was healthier. They'll talk about different things. What they don't realize and what they conveniently forget is that for all of the negatives that we will expound upon today, we have access to food that our ancestors didn't have. And mm-hmm. I know that many people, women, if they lived to be 30, they were old when they were 30. And many of them died. Children died at a huge rate. I mean, if you had 5 children, you were lucky if one survived. So, you know, you have all these things that people forget. But we also have so many good things that are occurring today because of technologies that have been developed. And I think it's becoming important that we inform each other. And that's where your book is so, I think, so significant, because you go into metabolic testing and people may say, well, it's all very simple. It isn't simple, because we're also very unique. And what might be absolutely fabulous for one person is toxic for another. I know people that are suffering from malnutrition, and I look at them and I say, you don't get it. And they go, well, I'm this, I'm that, I'm the other. But they don't have a clue about how their bodies are really working. They have bought into a theme. I don't care what that theme is, but they are not examining that theme. And especially as they get older, they're going through a lot of pain and suffering that they should not have to go through. And it is related to diet, but not in the way that they perceive it.
Sure. And, you know, I really ask the reader to work with me in this book. This is a very interactive book. I'm sure it sounds like you have read probably just as many, if not twice as much, health books as I have. I'm always reading some sort of new health book, and I learn tons of information. And then what do I do with it? Right? Mm-hmm. You know, I have this great idea. Oh, I'm going to start doing this, and then I never think about it again. In this book, I force the reader to stop every few pages, think about what they've just learned, and then how are they going to apply this information to their own unique situation. And I think it's really important that we stop to reflect and try to gain even a tiny bit of objectivity, because it's so easy to just get stuck in our rut. And it's hard to break that inertia.
Mm-hmm. It really is. It really is. And I don't care what a person's age is. I don't care if you're young, middle-aged, or older. I have seen elderly people's lives turned around when they understood that what we're dealing with is the chemistry, our physiological chemistry, that we've inherited from ancestors, that maybe through our style of life we have created a shift in certain patternings in the body. But if we're informed, then we realize that we have this responsibility. Just like we take care of our automobiles and we have given a diagnostic, we need to give ourselves the diagnostics. And that is one of the most significant parts of your book, Own Your Wellness, is becoming aware that there are tests that you can do. And you can find out about people that can help you interpret them. And
absolutely.
You've got so many different aspects of information in this book. And it is in a layperson's language, which I think is fabulous. And even if
you just
took a section at a time, it's great. Now, you have a website, and it is D for Daniela. It's dfitlife.com. And people can go there. They'll find out more information about this. And something that I think is so important, too, and you said you might write a book about this, so I'm going to encourage you to do that. And that is the difference between the male physiology and the female physiology, because so many tests are done more on men than on women. And the differences are just incredible. But you bring some of that out here. And I think respecting that batch of differences is really powerful, and people can enjoy a quality of life. So, Daniela Forrest, I'm so glad that we had the chance to have this conversation. I know your book is going to do very well, Own Your Wellness, giving you the tools to break through your health plateau. I want to thank you for being my guest.
Thank you, Donna. I had a lot of fun.
I am so glad. So did I. Well, we are taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. I've got more good things to share with you. Don't forget to check this out, Own Your Wellness by Daniela Forrest. It is a powerhouse of a publication. And if you're like me, you will use a yellow highlighter when you go through the book. And I'd say bend the pages on the tip, whatever it is that you want to do. She brings some excellent information out. Heck, I want you to be around. Yes, me too. So let's be personally responsible for our own wellness and work with those medical professionals that we find ourselves having to interact with. Remember, they never know it all. Neither do we. The Donna Sebo Show is heard weekdays, Monday through Friday, 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time. Callers are welcome to call in during the second half of the program at 253-582-5597. Please note that the announcement is made at the bottom of the hour if I'm not in studio, able to take phone calls. Warriors for Peace is heard every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. For current information regarding my email newsletter, programming, and appearances, go to DelphiInternational.com. For information on publications, including my award-winning children's books, audiobooks, and more, go to Mrs. Sebo's Classics.com. This is Donna Sebo. If you or someone you know is an author and would like to be interviewed on The Donna Sebo Show or Warriors for Peace, please send a copy of the publication along with contact information, phone number, email, and website to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. That's The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. Please allow 6 to 8 weeks for review. Thank you. Who's coming up on The Donna Sebo Show and Warriors for Peace? Well, we've got a powerhouse next week. I See Greatness in You, Larry Ragland. On Monday, The Path Through Forestry, Luke Eastwood in Ireland. Seder Magic with Dean Kirkland. He's in England. Yes, we're going to be going to Europe next week. And then on Thursday, we're going to be talking about all the glimmering stars with Mike Sullivan. And then finally, How to Hug a Porcupine with Andrew Flack. And there is just so much happening. And then also, we are going to be talking about the language of trust. And that's with Ingrid Christensen. That is going to be on the Warriors for Peace program. And we have so many fabulous and talented people that are in our environments, and I just feel very privileged to be able to bring them to the airwaves. So no matter where you are, you can listen to them. And don't forget that you can always go into the archives, and the latest 13 to 15 hours of programming is made available to you 24/7. And of course, on the player, those programs are also available, and they are, you know, they're going to be there for you as for a few weeks. But in the archives, too, we've got a lot of shows. We've got hundreds of shows there. So you could go in and listen to any one of the shows in the archives as you would like to do. And then our television programming that we're scheduling to film towards the end of this month, I will keep you informed about that. Don't forget about the author showcase. And there is so much that is going on. And I do have to say, here in the Pacific Northwest, it is absolutely gorgeous. We were in the low 80s today. And let me tell you, people were out and about. They are just thrilled that this weekend, even though there had been a prediction for rain, by golly, on Mother's Day, the sun is going to shine. Yes, we're not going to have any rain. So we feel very, very good about that. And for all of you moms out there and grandmas and aunties and all kinds of wonderful women that are going to be honored today, I just wish you the best on this upcoming Sunday, because it is wonderful to know that you're appreciated and that you're loved, and that more than anything else, you have, well, you've got a very special place in life. So congratulations to you. I hope you are just going to have an absolutely magnificent Mother's Day. I have a number of different things, and I'm in studio, so if you wanted to give me a call at 253-582-5597, you're welcome to do so. I'd be happy to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. If you have any kind of collectibles, there's often a lack of awareness on one's part. I know there was on mine to a degree, that you need to take care of it. And there's some wonderful suggestions that I came across in so many people as they get into the mature years. They maybe want to downsize, or they've got some items and they would like to leave it to their children or whomever, or an organization. I mean, there's just so many ways that you can take your items and find a nice home for them. Well, in the time that you have it, you want to make sure that you take care of it. And because technology has changed so rapidly in the past, oh, I'd say 40, 50 years, there's so many things that our ancestors were not aware of. And if you're like me and enjoy the programs like the Antiques Roadshow, etc., many times people will find items that are tremendously valued today because they're just not available otherwise. And sometimes in an attic or a basement, you know, things are found. Well, with artwork, there's just all kinds of, you know, ways that you can protect it. But you want to be thoughtful. If you have artwork in a bathroom, or if you have artwork, like a friend of mine would put a type of artwork outside, but that was specifically made to be outside. And there were pieces of art that when she moved into an apartment, she wanted to display it. Well, she was in an enclosed building that had a security situation, and the floor that she was on, because this was like a 3 or 4 story apartment building, she was able to put some of her beautiful artwork outside of her apartment, and it looked just lovely. You always knew where she lived because she had these lovely, lovely paintings that were on the outside. She didn't have enough space on the inside of the apartment, but they were not subject to damage in from elements or anything else because it was enclosed. But when you have something in a bathroom, you've got to be very thoughtful because you're going to have the dampness. And if you, you know, if you're a female, you're using hairspray. Guys use hairspray too, I guess. But the humidity in the kitchen, artwork that you might want to have in the kitchen, you have to be aware that heat, oils in the air can affect it. And one of the things, and I know this is real, if you have a place that you want to hang a painting over a fireplace, well, we did that. And I will tell you, there was a fire that was so hot in our fireplace at that time that it actually caused bubbles in the painting. In fact, it's a wonderful thing to talk about. Whenever we have visitors, they notice that there's something a little different about that oil painting. And we always enjoy sharing that story. But you want to be very careful where you put artwork so that it doesn't get that exposure, like above the fireplace. It's the same thing with putting a television above a fireplace area. You need to really be thoughtful because of the heat. If you have an insert, or there is some type of insulation that would keep the heat from, you know, hitting the painting, and that's a good thing. But believe me, it can create a mess very, very quickly. Also, papers. If you have letters, you have old photographs, you know, old Polaroid photographs, that type of thing, it is highly recommended. Any kind of unframed art, photos, prints, you can even have maps or trading cards. They're all fragile. Why? Because they are on paper. Pastels, watercolors, they're very, very difficult to keep from becoming damaged. So this is something where if you can put your items in an archival box and have acid paper, acid-free paper, not acid paper, but acid-free paper, foam core or cardboard between those items. That'll keep them so that they will be preserved very, very nicely. One of the things when people start doing genealogy, they will find old letters and they will say, gee, how am I going to preserve these? Because the paper, just like old books, sometimes the paper that has been used, for example, in books, it'll turn brown. It gets very, very tissuey, very, very delicate. And that it all depends on the constitution of the paper and the inks that were used on the paper. So those things can be protected. And then antique furniture. if you have antique furniture, just draw, you know, with a very soft, damp rag. And if you have intricate carvings, use a dry, soft brush to get into those crevices to get the dust and dirt out. And this is something that a lot of people, because it seems like in this era, there will be the statement, oh, nobody wants any of that old furniture anymore, but it's beautifully done. Many times the handiwork of craftsmen, of items that were made in the 1700s, the furniture is still good. When you go into Europe, there's many places you'll find that have absolutely magnificent furnishings. And the craftsmen did all the work by hand. It's just amazing. So if you like that kind of thing, you know, those makeup brushes that are made with those very fine sable hairs, that's a great dusting brush to use. And they say also you want to make sure that you really pay attention when you're vacuuming with antique furniture. You don't want to have big gouges in it. But it's something, you know, we take a lot of things for granted. And taking care of things is very, very important, I think. I've always felt that whatever I had, I was like a custodian. The adage, you can't take it with you, is very true. And the thing is that there will be someone at some time that may want what you have and would say, gee, look at how well this was preserved. When I used to watch programs about collectors, and I still enjoy them at various times when I have a chance to see one. But you have these people that are collectors, and they really get into taking care of whatever they've got, whether it's a museum with military history and all kinds of items, or it can be any kind of a museum. People love to collect. So when you take good care of those things, there's going to be someone somewhere that's going to want to add to their collection. And maybe you want to sell items on, you know, eBay or, you know, Spotify. There's just so many places that you can sell things today. And jewelry, I was surprised at a suggestion that someone said, don't soak your jewelry because it can loosen stones or cause discoloration. Take a soft, dry toothbrush or a Q-tip dipped in alcohol and very gently go over jewelry. And if you've got costume jewelry, you have to be very careful because depending on the age, and if you've got something that's made with Bakelite, you want to know how to handle it or how to work with it so it's not going to be destroyed. And silver. Well, polishing silver once or twice a year. We don't have maids and butlers that are going to sit at a table and polish silver for hours. But I was not surprised to find out that it was recommended, once you polish it, to store the silver in flannel chamois bags. Don't ever use plastic wrap because the plastic adheres to the silver and damages the finish. So I just thought I would share those few little tips. But, you know, we take care of the things, if you take care of the things that you have, and your children do not want them. Lots of times, younger generations say, I don't want what mom and dad had. But many times they do. And I know in my husband's family, when his mother died, his father had died many years before the mother did, and when his mother died, it was really a challenge because almost everything she had, she had 10 kids, and 9 of them were surviving at the time that she died, and they all wanted something of hers. And so it was a real challenge to the eldest brother who was having to divvy things up. And I know that there were items that were very, very significant, and certain ones to each member of the family. So it was quite a challenge to divvy those things up, and many times people, when they find that they're downsizing, they ask their kids, if you want it, you can take it because I'm not going to want it anymore because I don't have space for it. And if you're able to do that, then I'd say give it away when you're ready to give it away. It is a good thing to do, because then you know that it is really going to be taken care of. Donna Sebo here, 253-582-5597. There's a gentleman, his name is George Lee. He is the first Asian American male ballet dancer. I didn't know anything about this man, and I thought I would share his story with you because it is so inspiring to me. He was a man that had the most incredible life. And so often, we are told you should know what you want to do by the time you're in high school. Well, we can have all kinds of ideas, but sometimes life puts us on a different path than maybe we had thought we were going to be experiencing. Well, he loved to dance. And it was all because of his mom. She was a professional dancer. His mother was Polish. And they lived in Hong Kong. And he said, I was very small. Now, he, again, is part Asian. So his small stature and build, he had a lot of flexibility. And when he would see his mother doing her exercises, when he was just a little guy, she said, do you want to do exercises with me? And he said, you bet. So right there with his mom, he would mimic her and do the different dance exercises that she had. Well, because of that, because of her training and her patience with her son, by the age of 7, he was performing in a nightclub. Now, this was during World War II, and they had to make a living. And he said, I got very lucky. He said, there were Russian people working in the club as dancers, and they would help him out, train him. He just fit right in, and he would take the classes that the adults were taking. And he said, when you're 7 years old, it's pretty hard to keep up with the pros. But he managed to do it. And after the war, he said, when the communists started moving into Shanghai in 1949, his mother really got scared because it was very bad in Shanghai. Well, there was a United Nations refugee camp in the jungle in the Philippines, and they went there. They were supposed to stay for 4 months, and then, while they were there, the mother was offered an opportunity to go to Australia. However, because he was half Chinese, she said, there's no way we're going to survive there. I might make it because I'm Polish, but because you're half Japanese, they're not going to want to support you in any way, shape, or form. Not only that, but they found out that he was not going to be allowed to go with her. So they ended up staying in the Philippines at this refugee camp. They stayed there for 2 years, and then they were allowed to come into the United States. So his mother knew, because he was mixed race, that there was going to be some challenges. And she said, you need to know something. You need to know you're going to have to be 10 times better than anyone else. Well, when they got into New York, there was a school of American ballet, and it was the training school for the New York City ballet. And because of the Russians that he had when he was a little boy and the entire time that they were able to work with him for dancing, then by golly, his Russian training was so outstanding that George Balanchine was choreographing the Nutcracker, the Christmas program that's just so dearly loved by millions. And when he heard that there was a Chinese boy in the school, he wanted to use him for the Chinese tea dance. And he wanted to know how George could leap and the turns he could do. And he was very impressed with George. He said, this was great. However, because he was so short, he was shorter than most of the men in the dance company for the Nutcracker, and it just wasn't going to work at all. So what happened? He heard about a Broadway show, and they were looking for Asians. So he was auditioning along with hundreds of others, and he did a solo from Tchaikovsky's The Sleeping Beauty. Now, the people that were judging did not know anything about that particular piece. However, there was a very special dancer, world-renowned, that did know what he was doing, and he did know about the piece that he was dancing and the choreography was the same, and that person was Gene Kelly, and he really liked George, and he thought, well, after all the auditions had been done, he was going home. He hadn't heard anything. And Gene Kelly went up to him and said, why don't you take this job? You could learn something new and get paid for it. Do you know what? George ended up being cast in the Flower Drum Song and learned jazz dance. And Gene Kelly made a spot for him in one number where he could do solo jumping, because he was so good at it. And after that, whatever show he could get into, he danced and danced and danced. He went on the road with Carol Channing as one of her 10 chorus boys. But he said, you know, you only can stay as a boy for so long. And he said, I realized that I had to get out of dancing. All right, so what do you do when you're a dancer? Where do you go? What do you think you're going to do? Well, he had to retire from show business because he realized that that dancing cycle, he was just not going to find the work that he wanted. And he said it was in 1980. And one of his friends suggested, why don't you get trained as a blackjack dealer? Well, George's mother didn't like that at all. Of course, he's an adult now. She was concerned he was going to get involved with a mob. But that's not what happened. He said dealing ended up being his second career. And he enjoys the environment. He said, the casino people are wonderful. We help each other out. And now that I'm a senior, he said, they let me deal sitting down. Customers come in. They look for me. They call me by name. He said, it's like I've got this huge family. Well, that wasn't the end of his story. It wasn't all that long ago that a journalist by the name of Jennifer Lynn contacted him. She heard about him dancing for Balanchine. She wanted to do a documentary on him. And it was released, 2024. He said, I'm really proud. And he said, there was so much I had forgotten about my life and the twists and turns that I went through. He said, I've worked all my life and I'm still working. His age, he is 89 years old. He's a blackjack dealer at the Four Queens Casino in Las Vegas. The documentary, I haven't looked it up yet, but you might want to. It's titled 10 Times Better. Wonderful, wonderful story. I thought I had to share that with you. Because no matter what your age is, life sometimes will put you into situations of opportunity that in a million years you would never have imagined to be possible. Just love those stories myself. And I think they're so inspiring because we can get so down in the mouth about our lives and what we're going through and how things are just so terrible and, gee, what will we do if we lose this career or that career or this situation or we have to move? You know, all kinds of things can happen to us. But remember one thing. You're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. And I will tell you, I think George is the perfect image of that. Because he didn't look down on whatever needed to be done. And at a youthful 89 years of age, he is still making a big difference just by being who he is. And he got to share his story in a very special way. Donna Sebo here. Have a fabulous weekend for all you moms out there. God bless you all. I'll be talking with you on Monday. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.